we left off in. Let's jump there, Job chapter 8. When we come to Job and we start studying any Hebrew poetry, always remember, and it's difficult when we're in the book of Job, but remember that one of the interesting things about poetry is the language of love. It communicates love. It communicates very endearing things. And as this whole story is communicated in poetry, you realize that God's ultimate design is good. That through the suffering, through the incredible difficulty that Job is experiencing, yet God has purposed good. And of course, this is written in retrospect. You know, after they've gone through it, now these things have been written down. I don't picture them while he was going through the suffering, you know, to be able to form this, although I'm sure that some of these things were formed and then eventually put together in a book. But it's the language of love. For instance, if I were to come home and say, "Hi, honey, I love you, I'm home," that communicates one thing. But if I were to say, "Oh, honey, I would I could make thee believe I love thee," you know, it just has a more powerful effect. It's on a different wavelength. Poetry. Well, God is communicating this. Now, when we look at Job in his responses to the Lord, it's one thing. When we see his friends respond, it's interesting. Bildad now, we're going to hear from him in chapter 8. Bildad, the Shuhite, that's probably not in reference to how tall he was or anything, but if you ever want to win a trivia contest, you can always ask who's the shortest person in the Bible, and someone might say Nehemiah, but that won't work. But Shuhite will get you every time, so just for fun. Now you'll never forget this guy. But he says this. He says, "How long will you speak these things, and the words of your mouth be like a strong wind?" Now he's responding to Job's complaint, his frustration, his searching, his, "God, what are you doing? You know, why are you even paying attention to me? Why don't I just die?" And Job is going on and ranting about some things. And Bildad is just, you know, he's not one of the errors of Job's friends was the fact that they answered him, they answered his words, but with no consideration of what produced those words. It would be very, very unfeeling for someone to be in incredible suffering, and in their suffering, maybe they express something that isn't exactly right, for you to correct them, for you to say, "Oh, you've got it wrong, excuse me, let me straighten you out here." I mean, that's what his friends are basically doing. In fact, they're accusing him just like Satan accused him. Satan is the one that accused him to God and says, "You know, Job's a hypocrite. He's not serving you for nothing. I mean, you bless him and you're doing all these things for him. God, take away some of those blessings and he'll curse you to your face. We'll see that he's just a hypocrite." Well, his friends are basically accusing him of just being hypocritical. "Job, you're pretending to be righteous. You must have done something wrong." So Bildad is slightly less impressive than Eliphaz. He's not really an original thinker. He's quoting Proverbs and quoting other people here, but still just claiming that Job is nothing. So he goes on and he's kind of upset at Job. In verse 3, he says, "Does God subvert judgment or does the Almighty pervert justice?" In other words, it's an open and shut case. Obviously, God is just, so therefore you've done something wrong, so therefore admit it, kind of. And he even goes on and takes a low blow. In verse 4, he says, "If your sons have sinned against him, he's cast them away for their transgression." He's saying, not only are you guilty, but your sons are probably guilty too. That's why they died. "If you would earnestly seek God and make your supplication to the Almighty, if you were pure and upright, surely he would awake for you and prosper your rightful dwelling place. Though your beginning was small, yet your latter end would increase abundantly. For inquire, please, of the former age, and consider the things discovered by their fathers." So he's basically saying, hey, you know, you would have known if God really thought you were righteous, he would have recovered you by now. And though your beginning started out small, your latter end would increase abundantly. Now that is true, and that will happen. Job will increase in the latter end abundantly because God will vindicate him. But Bildad doesn't have it right here because he's judging from the externals. He's trying to, again, oversimplify God's dealing, and that's a mistake that you and I can make. We can go through trials and not know why. There can be a reason that we don't see, just as there was with Job. There was a reason that he did not see. And there's a greater purpose that God is working through the difficulty, though we can't ascribe to any reason. There doesn't seem to be any reason to some of the suffering that we go through. And if we take a simplification like some teachers are wont to do, well, you know, you must have sinned, or you don't have enough faith, or some other thing. You haven't followed the 10 secrets to the Christian walk. You haven't followed the 12 steps to, you know, walking righteously. And they've got some formula they're following. And if you deviate from that formula, then, you've blown it. And now you're suffering as a result. And they can tell you that they've discovered that formula because, after all, look at their life. They're doing quite well right now, thank you. And they don't understand that it could be tomorrow that they suffer something. I know that God used a knee operation in my life to get me out of that oversimplification in walking with God. I thought it was pretty cool that God was really pleased with me because I was healthy, I was doing well in school, and I was confessing positively many things. You know, I was claiming by faith many things. And then I tore a cartilage in the wrestling room. And you would have been amused to see me on that little gurney as I was sitting there with my knees all locked up. And I was telling my coach, "Don't worry, coach, it's going to be okay. I'm just going to tell this thing." And I'm going to tell this thing right now, you're fine. And it was this formula faith that I was on as a young Christian, this poison teaching that I'd gotten a hold of. And I was just, you know, I thought I was claiming by faith. Not knowing faith is not something that I can produce. Faith is a response to what God has said. Now, if God has spoken through His Spirit to touch me and heal me, then I can receive it. I can believe. And there are people that the Lord will give them that faith to be healed, and they'll be healed. But if you don't have that faith to be healed, if God has not said to you, "I'm going to heal you," you can't have that faith, because faith is a response to God's Word. And God distributes His gifts severally as He wills. He knows His purposes. But if He doesn't heal you right away, there's a greater purpose. Well, God certainly authored a greater purpose in my life, having to go through that painful knee operation. After all my confessions, you know, were off in the dust somewhere. They didn't work. And I was sitting there looking pretty stupid in front of my coach and my other friends, and I told them, "It's going to be okay." But God used it to get me back on track with Him, to walk with Him in relationship rather than a formula. And this is where Bildad and a lot of Job's friends are. They're just in a formula relationship. He goes on to say, "For inquire, please, of the former age, and consider the things discovered by their fathers. For we were born yesterday and know nothing, because our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and utter words from their heart?" Oh, this is true. In comparison to some of the ancients that lived, the antediluvians before the flood, who lived 500, 600, 700, 800 years, imagine what you could accomplish in that amount of time. Think about your productive, you know, years from what, 20 to maybe 50, 30 short years that you're really productive, maybe more, you know. When you're in your 50s, 60s, you actually can accomplish quite a bit. So let's just extend that all the way to 60 or even 70, that you could really have an impact before you retire. Just a short period of time, 50 short years. Imagine the antediluvians, what they could have accomplished with a productivity in their life of 500, 600, 700 years. What they would have been able to figure out. You see, the evolutionists have it all wrong. We haven't evolved, we've devolved. You know, the brilliance of the ancient man, you know, we've looked at the things like the pyramids and wonder, you know, we can't even produce that today. How did they do that? How did they build that? And the only explanation a lot of the evolutionists are coming up with is, well, it's obvious that it must have been from peoples that seeded this planet before, because obviously, they didn't have the intelligence. We have evolved, right? We're more genius now today than we ever were. But it doesn't fly. I believe that it's very possible the pyramids were built by the antediluvians in that period of time, perhaps survived the flood, and is a testimony to the genius of a person who lived long lifespans and were able to figure out great, complexing problems. But we were born yesterday and know nothing in comparison. He says, "Can the papyrus grow up without a marsh? Now, he's going to use some illustrations from nature to try to bolster his point that Job is a hypocrite. And there's, in fact, interesting comparisons here, because a papyrus would be a good picture of a hypocrite. Can the papyrus grow up without marsh? Can the reeds flourish without water? While it is yet green and not cut down, it withers before any other plant. So are the paths of all who forget God, and the hope of the hypocrite will perish. So he uses this illustration of the reed and the marsh. Now, a reed grows rapidly. A person sometimes can have an initial testimony of they've believed in Jesus, but they haven't really gotten grounded. A reed is also hollow and empty. If you tried to use it as a staff, it would, you know, just bend. It would be useless. It's full of water. It loves water, so it's unstable. It looks good on the outside, but it's a false confidence. Never really emptied of self. It bears no fruit. It's religion. Just like people who are hypocritical, their religion oftentimes is all negative. It's more like, well, I don't do this, and I don't do that, and I don't do this. Kind of a legalistic thing. We're in a true relationship with the Lord. It's not what you don't do. It's you enjoy the Lord in fellowship that you wouldn't want to do those things because they're not you anymore. It's not like you're priding yourself on what you don't do. You just enjoy the Lord. You wouldn't want to do those things. It's not you. But the reed is absolutely dependent upon the miry mud, and I think that's the significant point that he's made here. It's dependent. The proverb or the prophet Jeremiah said that cursed is the man who trusts in man. He is like a shrub in the wilderness. Now, when you go out in the desert and you see plants growing in the rainy season, they generally flourish up really quickly, and then because they have no root, when the dry season comes, they dry up again, and then they become tumbleweeds and they just blow away. Very dependent upon the rain. Well, as a Christian, if we were a hypocrite's very dependent upon good things happening to continue to follow. If those things stop, then they dry up. Now, Job's friends are contending, you're a hypocrite, because now it's been revealed you're a sinner, because look at all the bad things that are happening to you. But they fail to see, if Job were a hypocrite, he would have left following God since it's so tough. So it really doesn't even make sense, their argument. He goes on to compare another item in nature, whose confidence shall be cut off, whose trust is a spider's web. He leans on his house, but it does not stand. He holds it fast, but it does not endure. He grows green in the sun, his branches spread out in the garden. His roots wrap around the rock heap and look for a place in the stones. If he is destroyed from his place, then I will deny him, saying, I have not seen you. Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the earth others will grow. That term, joy of his way, is kind of a very difficult phrase. Some have translated it, this is the end of the godless. In other words, finally it just all burns up. It means it comes to nothing. All of their walk and their religion ends up as nothing, because they were dependent upon the steady supply, and when that's gone, it completely dries up. They need constant attention. Constant encouragement. It's a good test for us sometimes. You know, when we're walking with the Lord and we're encouraged by others around us, and that's always good to have encouragement and to be encouragers. But don't depend too much upon encouragement by others. Because if your ears are so in tune to the praises and the encouragement of others, if it's not there anymore, what will you do? Will you be bitter? Will you be frustrated? I know there are people that leave Calvary after a while because they feel friends have let them down, and, you know, it's hypocritical, and how could they have done that if they're Christians? They call themselves Christians there. And I think what happens is, yes, there are going to be times when people will let you down, but if your trust is in people, then you'll have a very shaky foundation, because eventually the Lord will remove all those props. He may move you into an area where you have no support other than Him. And so the dependency upon just the circumstances is very shallow. But Bildad, in a way, encourages Job. He says, but God will not cast away the blameless, nor will he uphold the evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughing and your lips with rejoicing. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the dwelling place of the wicked will come to nothing. So kind of a semi-encouragement, you know, Job, we think maybe you will make it in the end. Well, Job answered and said, truly, I know it is so. Now, Job constantly throughout this whole book is saying, I know these things. I know these things. Guys, you're not telling me anything new. You know, I'm not inferior to you in knowledge. I understand these things. But now he asks, how can a man be righteous before God? If the blameless will, their end will be good, fine. But how can one be blameless before God? Psalm 130, verse 3 says, if God marked iniquities, who could stand? And truly, every idle word that a man speaks, Jesus said, will be given to give an account for in the day of judgment. Every idle word. Now, thankfully, we will not meet that judgment because our judgment was met on the cross. You know, when you read things about judgment coming, understand this. You've already met your judgment. All judgment was fulfilled in what Jesus did for you on the cross, if you're a believer in Jesus. If you do not put your trust in Jesus, then you will stand before that great white throne judgment. And every idle word, everything you've done, everything you have ever said, you'll have to give an account for and pay to the last farthing or penny, as we would say. If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of a thousand. How are you going to argue with God? God is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who's hardened himself against him and prospered? Look at Pharaoh. He hardened himself against God. Did it pay off? No. He removes the mountains and they don't know when he overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble. He commands the sun and it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He made the Bear, Orion, and the Pleiades in the chambers of the south. Now those are the northern constellations that they would have been very familiar with. And of course, the chambers of the south would have been unseen to Job, but he would have been aware that there were constellations in the south. He does great things, past finding out. Yes, wonders without number. If he goes by me, I don't see him. If he moves past, I don't perceive him. You know, are you aware if God was right here? Can you see him? Can you perceive him? God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. So he's conscious that he cannot have in his physical frame an address with God. He can't spend time with him in that sense. If he takes away, who can hinder him? Who could say to God, what are you doing? I love that, you know. If you see God doing something, hey, what do you think you're doing? Who can say that to God? Who can charge God with that? I know as a young Christian I did. I'd always argue with God. Why are you doing this, God? Why am I going through this? Why is this happening to me, God? And I was whining a lot, you know, in that first, second year as a Christian. You know, the first year was kind of the honeymoon. The second year was like, you know, getting down and having to learn how to walk by faith and not feeling a whole lot and feeling a little dry and wondering, what are you doing, God? You don't understand this. And arguing with God, God, I think I know better for my life than you do. But it was all a bunch of wind. The allies of the proud lie prostrate beneath him. How can I answer him and choose my words to reason with him? For though I were righteous, I couldn't answer him. I would beg mercy of my judge. If he called me and answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. So Job is, you know, he doesn't have any reason for what's happening to him, but he is attributing it to God ultimately. He will not allow me to catch my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it's a matter of strength, indeed, he is strong. And then of justice, who will appoint my day in court? So you get introduced to this court scene of having to appeal your case to God. He says, though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. What a good picture here of what sometimes people in their self-righteousness think that they have a standing before God, think themselves quite well. But if you look, notice here, he says, even if I were blameless, even if in my own mind I could think I'm doing perfectly, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse. You know, I've often wondered that if in judgment time, God won't have to pull out the law and say, you violated this, you violated that, you violated this. All he'll have to do is pull out a recording of the things we have said, the ways we've judged people, the things we've expected of others, and show how we don't even meet our own standard. And even if we were judged by our own standard, it would be enough to put us away. Because isn't that the truth? We expect people to do this or that when we ourselves make excuses for ourselves. You know, we've got excuses why I don't do that, but others should. It's amazing how hypocritical we can be in that respect. Job says, I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life. You know, it's all one thing, he says. It's all one thing whether I live or die. Therefore, he destroys the blameless and the wicked. But I love this picture here. I'm blameless, yet I don't know myself. Isn't that a good picture of where we are sometimes? You know, in our own minds, we've done right. We can't see anything we've done wrong. And yet we really don't know ourselves. That's why we pray, Lord, search my heart. Try me to see if there be any wicked way in me. And you know, it's not a pleasant thing to see our heart. Sometimes God will use trials or difficulties with people or problems that arise to reveal just how ugly our hearts are. But he does that not to distress us, but to show us that we need to come to him for some more washing and cleansing. And let his word just give us that shower and cleanse a lot of the gunk that's in there. And oh, how you feel after you spend time in the Word of God. You feel like, oh, Lord, you've vindicated me. I come to you in my emptiness for forgiveness, and you've filled me. You've forgiven me and now filled me. And it's such a clean feeling to know that he is there. The scourge slays suddenly. He laughs at the plight of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who else could it be? In other words, he's even attributing the wicked judges to the Lord's doing ultimately. But now my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away, they see no good. They pass like swift ships, like an eagle swooping on its prey. If I say I will forget my complaint, I'll put off my sad face and smile. I'm afraid of all my sufferings. Job says, hey, time is just passing and still I've had no end of this suffering. And he says, and if I try to forget my complaint, even if I try to grin and bear it, we would say, just grin and bear it. He says, I'm afraid I couldn't do that perfectly. I'm afraid of my sufferings, and I know you wouldn't hold me innocent. In other words, you'd blame me for something else then. So he's kind of like feeling like, you know, you picture him trying to analyze this thing, and he's trying to figure out what God's doing, and then he says, no, if I do this, and you'll do that, and I'm afraid of that. If I am condemned, why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow water and cleanse my hands with soap, yet you'll plunge me into the pit, and my own clothes will abhor me. Even if I think I'm doing the very best I can, you'll find something wrong with me, God. There's always something there. For he is not a man as I am, that I may answer him, that we should go to court together, nor is there any mediator between us who may lay his hand on us both. Let him take his rod away from me. Do not let dread of him terrify me, then I would speak and not fear him, but it is not so with me. Of course, here we come to that heavenly court scene and that cry for a mediator, that which you and I have received so abundantly in Jesus Christ, the perfect mediator, a perfect choice to stand between us and God. No man can be in that place. No man can play priest anymore. God is our high priest. He himself, Jesus, has become our high priest. We can stand now in the presence of God himself because of Jesus, our mediator. What an incredible truth that Job was not aware of at this point. Now, my soul loathes my life. I'll give free course to my complaint. I'll speak in the bitterness of my soul. I'll say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. Now, he's coming back to the first person here. You know, previously he's referring in the second person to God and what God is doing. Now he's speaking to God directly. Show me why you contend with me. Does it seem good to you that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands and smile on the counsel of the wicked? You know, he's wondering, God, why are you doing this? Why do you despise what you've made? You've made me. Now do you hate me? And then almost a bit of irony, he goes on to say, do you have eyes of flesh, or do you see as a man sees? Are you days like the days of a mortal man? Are your years like the days of a mighty man, that you should seek for my iniquity and search out for my sin? Although you know that I'm not wicked, and there is no one who can deliver from your hand. So he says, you know, God, is it possible that you only see as man sees? You only see the outside? He says, but no, I know that that you see all things. So he basically jumps on that and then he corrects himself. Your hands have made me and fashioned me in an intricate unity. You know, you would destroy me. Remember, I pray that you've made me like clay. And will you turn me into dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? What a picture, you know. Clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews. You have granted me life and favor. Your care has preserved my spirit. So he's saying, hey, you created me. What a great picture of God forming someone in the womb here. God intricately forming them. Do you know in the very moment of conception when the genes are shared there and the little egg is fertilized, that at that moment, every bit of detailed information, the number of hairs in your head, whether you lose your hair at a certain time in life, whether this or this or this, all the details of your existence, how you will look, even much of your personality traits are in that tiny little fertilized egg. All the information's right there. And then God just brings it out. It's fascinating when you think of how God has formed us. The intricacies. The information system. And these things you have hidden in your heart. And I know this was with you. If I sin, then you mark me and will not acquit me of my iniquity. What he's saying is, is this my destiny? I mean, I've got nothing else to do. If I'm wicked, woe to me. If I'm righteous, I can't lift up my head. I'm full of disgrace. See my misery. If my hand is exalted, you hunt me like a fierce lion. And again, show yourself awesome against me. In other words, what's the difference between being good or evil? I've cleansed my heart in vain. This is similar to what David said in the Psalm, in Psalm 73, when he saw Asaph, or one of the psalmists. I always confuse that with David, but David didn't write Psalm 73. But the psalmist says, you know, I've cleansed my heart in vain. You know, I'm doing all these things right, and I'm suffering, and yet the wicked, they're doing everything wrong, and they're doing great out there. They're making it rich on the stock market. They're living it up. They're having a great time, and it's not fair. But you see, they don't see the end result. And that's what Job is wrestling with. It seems to him all the same now. Whether I'm good or bad, I'm suffering the same thing. If my head is exalted, you hunt me like a fierce lion. Again, show yourself awesome. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your indignation toward me. Now, he may be referring to his suffering, or he may be referring to his friends. You're only increasing witnesses against me, accusations against me, charges and war ever with me. Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Now he turns gears and he starts questioning why he was born again. Oh, that I had perished and no eye had seen me. It would have been as though I'd not been. I would have been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Cease. Leave me alone that I may take a little comfort before I go to the place from which I will not return, to the land of darkness and the shadow of death, a land as dark as darkness itself, as the shadow of death without any order, where even the light is like darkness. A picture here that, you know, in those days they had little hope of the resurrection. It was very vague. It was very shadowy. You kind of get the feeling, too, is he's just slightly depressed at this point. Now Zophar, the Naamathite, answered. Now Zophar comes on the scene and, you know, it's interesting, his comments, his expressions, his all he really does is regurgitate what everyone else has said, what Bildad and what Eliphaz has said, and really doesn't even do that great of a job of it, just duplicating everything. He has this message here in chapter 11, then he also in chapter 20, the last time we hear from Zophar. But he answered and said, should not the multitude of words be answered, and should a man full of talk be vindicated? Should your empty talk make men hold their peace? When you mock, should no one rebuke you? For you have said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in your eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against you, and he would show you the secrets of wisdom, for they would double your prudence. Know therefore that God exacts from you less than your iniquity deserves. What a great friend. Job, you're not even getting everything you deserve. You deserve worse than this. Now, in a way, it's true as a whole. We have received certainly less than our iniquities deserve, and that can be certainly said of a Christian. We've received a lot less than we deserve. What a great merciful thing God has done for us. But I don't think he intends this to Job. He's saying, you deserve more, Job. Can you search out deep things of God? Can you find out the limits of the Almighty? They are higher than the heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, which was the expression of hell. Deeper than hell, what can you know? Their measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If he passes by, imprisons and gathers to judgment, then who can hinder him? Well, Job has said the same thing, really. Again, he's not repeating anything different. He sees wickedness also. Will he not consider it? For an empty-headed man will be wise when a wild donkey's colt is born a man. Now, he's waxing a little, poetic here, but he's saying, will be wise when a donkey's colt is born a man. It's kind of like us saying, I'll believe you when hell freezes over type of a thing. Well, if you would prepare your heart and stretch out your hands toward him, and for your iniquity were in your hand, and you'd put it far away and would not let wickedness dwell in your tents, then surely you could lift up your face without spot. Yes, you could be steadfast and not fear. Now, each of these four steps toward repentance, but Zophar is assuming Job has not done these things. Certainly he's prepared his heart. He's directed his heart in humility to God. He's stretched out his hands in prayer. He's seeking the Lord. Certainly there's nothing that he's conscious of that he's doing wrong. He's put it away. He's not letting any wickedness dwell in his tent. There's something very sweet sometimes about what happens when we go through a period of trial and difficulty. We do search our hearts. We do seek the Lord. And then we're very conscious of anything that's displeasing to him. We're very afraid of it. We hate sin. We loathe sin because of what it does in our life. We don't want that thing to happen to us. We want to put it away from us. And we learn to cultivate a real hatred towards sin and evil because we know how much it hurts us. We know it may go down smoothly, but at the end is like wormwood and bitter. It tastes great in the mouth, but when you swallow it, it gives you an empty feeling. So we learn to cultivate that, and Job certainly would have been in that category. So there's nothing here that is not wrong, but he's just applying it and assuming Job isn't doing this. He says, because you would forget your misery and remember it as waters that have passed away, and your life would be brighter than noonday, and though you were dark, you would be like the morning, and you would be secure because there is hope. Yes, you dig around and take your rest in safety, and you'd also lie down and no one would make you afraid. Yes, many would court your favor, but the eyes of the wicked will fail, and they shall not escape, and their hope, loss of life. So far, it doesn't really add a lot to the discussion here. He really is just bringing out some old axioms that Job, you haven't done what you're supposed to do because, again, the underlying assumption, you're suffering, and if you say that you're innocent, then you're charging God with doing something against you that was wrong. And that's it's the tunnel vision that they have. It's the tunnel vision that they're experiencing. It's just kind of almost that legalistic life. Job, if you say you're innocent, then you're actually making God like he's done something wrong. Because God wouldn't punish the righteous. He wouldn't do this to anybody righteous. So they're really mad at Job for even implying that he's innocent. I mean, that's the thing that really irks them. You wonder why they're so mad at Job for implying he's innocent? Because they know God is punishing him, and that would make God, in their eyes, unjust. And they could not even imagine that. So in their theology, it's kind of like an either-or thing, therefore it can't be so. Well, Job answered and said, no doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. Just a little bit of sarcasm there. Hey, when you die, all wisdom's going to be gone. You are the people. Wisdom will die with you. But I have understanding as well as you. I'm not inferior to you. Indeed, who does not know such things as these? He's saying, yes, I know all that stuff. This is all basic, stuff that anyone should know. But I'm one mocked by his friends who called on God and he answered him, the just and blameless who is ridiculed. A lamp is despised in the thought of one who is at ease. It is made ready for those whose feet slip. In other words, if someone's doing well, and they can quite see their path. They don't need a lamp. But if your feet are slipping because it's dark, a lamp is very needy. He says, the tents of robbers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure in what God provides by his hand. In other words, there are times, guys, that people that are doing wrong do prosper for a time. And those provoke God seem to be doing quite well, so you don't have it all right. It's not cut and dry like you guys are talking about. But now ask the beasts, will they teach you? Now he's going to some lessons in the animal kingdom. He says, and the birds of the air, they'll tell you. Speak to the earth and it will teach you, and the fish of the sea will explain it to you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? Does not the ear test words and the mouth taste its food? Wisdom is with aged men, and with length of days understanding. Maybe he's being a little sarcastic here. He's using this illustration of the beasts, which would give a clear indication that things are not always fair. Sometimes the innocent animals suffer, and things don't always seem to be the case. But now he's almost sarcastically saying, "Hey, you should be wise as aged men. Length of days you should have understanding. But with him are wisdom and strength." From verse 13 on, he begins to speak about the sovereignty of God, and really comes clear in this point. This is very, very good. With him are wisdom and strength. He has counsel and understanding. If he breaks down a thing, it cannot be rebuilt. If he imprisons a man, there can be no release. If he withholds the waters, they dry up. If he sends them out, they overwhelm the earth. With him are strength and prudence. Now, there might be a reference here in regard to the flood, the great flood, that Job could have very well been close enough to, that he would have actually been an acquaintance with someone who came through the flood. In fact, when you look at the genealogy, the sons of Noah, the ages that they lived, would have taken them hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years after the flood, which would have brought some of them up into the time of Abraham, certainly would have been in the time of Job, and it's possible that Job could have even conversed with one of those ancient men who lived hundreds of years, one of the sons of Noah, who could have given him instruction and wisdom and insight. With him are strength and prudence. Verse 16, the deceived and the deceiver are his. He leads counselors away plundered and makes fools of the judges. He loosens the bonds of kings and binds their waist with a belt. He leads princes away plundered and overthrows the mighty. He deprives the trusted ones of speech and takes away the discernment of the elders. He pours contempt on princes and disarms the mighty. He uncovers deep things out of darkness and brings the shadow of death to light. He makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and guides them. Boy, that's something that our current administration in this nation could really learn from. It's God who makes a nation great, and it's also God who destroys a nation. For what purposes? Well, it could be where the people are in their hearts. Could be that we've received the nation or the leaders that we deserve, because that is where our hearts are. But God is the one that makes nations great. He's the one that raised up America to be such a light among nations for many of its years. And yet I see our years today as a nation declining. We're not the nation we once were. Though economically we may be boasting how proud we are and how strong we are, that could crash in a moment. That's all so tenuous. Our vulnerability with other nations, with nuclear terrorism, is so strong, we don't even know what could happen. We're so frail. We're so needy. This is not a time to be boasting of our strength as a nation. This is a time to be humbly standing before God, saying, God, keep us. Protect us. He takes away the understanding of the chiefs of the people of the earth. We may have a present case, an example of that. He makes us them wander in pathless wilderness. They grope in the dark without light. They misquote the Bible in occasions. He makes them stagger like a drunken man. So God is the one that raises up people and lowers people. God is sovereign. God is ultimately in charge. He is the one that does all these things. Behold, Job says, my eye has seen all this. My ears heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you, but I would speak to the Almighty and desire to reason with God. But you forgers of lies, you're all worthless physicians. So he's a little fed up with these guys, and they're quoting Proverbs. Oh, that you'd be silent and it would be your wisdom. Now, they were in the beginning, and that was their wisdom. For 7 days, they didn't say a word. And they just comforted Job by being there with him. But now they've talked and they've only antagonized him. He says, now hear my reasoning. Now listen to what I'm going to say to you guys. Heed the pleadings of my lips. Will you speak wickedly for God and talk deceitfully for him and show partiality for him? Will you contend for God? Will it be well with you when he searches you out? In other words, you think you guys are talking on God's behalf, but you don't know what you're talking about. You know, you're missing the point. You're oversimplifying God's work. You know, I've already pointed out that sometimes the wicked do prosper, he said. And so you can't just say this is the way it is. Will you mock him as one mocks a man? He'll surely rebuke you. If you secretly show partiality, will not his excellence make you afraid and the dread of him fall upon you? Your platitudes are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay. In other words, all your arguments are all empty. Hold your peace with me and let me speak. Then let him come on me what may. Let come on me what may. Why do I take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hands? Though he slay me, yet I'll trust in him. Even so, I'll defend my own ways before him. Now notice what he's saying here. I love this picture. They're saying, Job, because you're claiming you're innocent, you're a hypocrite. Because you're making God unjust. So you've only pretended to be righteous, but God has seen some secret sin in your life and now he's punishing you. Now what Job is saying is, hey, I'm not denying God. If I were a hypocrite, I would have left off following him long ago with this suffering. Though he slay me, I'll still obey him. I'm not going to stop following God. I believe in him. I know he's working. I just don't understand what's going on. So a very, very good argument, a very strong proof that Job was in the right and his friends were in the wrong. For he could say, though he slay me, I'll trust in him. What a great conclusion to have. I mean, look at the integrity of Job here. Look at the foundation. I would want that strength of character to be in me. That I could say the same thing, no matter what trial and difficulty I'm going through, not to get weary of well-doing, knowing that I'll reap in due time, knowing that one day the reward will be there. But even if it came down to the point where God was going to remove me from this earth, though he slay me, I'll still obey him. I'll trust in him. I'll know his purposes are good. I'll understand that he's got a reason, and I won't try to fight him on it. Maybe I would. Maybe I'd be like Job. I'd, you know, argue with God and question. And of course, Job is saying, hey, I just wish you'd take my life and bring me home. But he says, though he slay me, yet I'll trust in him. What a great verse to memorize and hide in your heart. It's such an expression of faith. He shall also be my salvation, for a hypocrite could not come before him. Hey, I wouldn't come if I was a hypocrite. Listen carefully to my speech and to my declaration with your ears. See now, I've prepared my case, and I know that I shall be vindicated. Who is he who will contend with me? If now I hold my tongue, I perish. Only two things do not do to me. Then I will not hide myself from you. Withdraw your hand far from me, and let not the dread of you make me afraid. So he's asking, Lord, don't withdraw your hand. He's saying, withdraw your hand. Take this thing away from me. And then also, don't let the dread of you make me afraid. I don't want to see the fullness of your power and your glory, because it would blow me away. Then call and I will answer. Or let me speak and you will respond to me. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and regard me as your enemy? Will you frighten a leaf driven to and fro? I'm nothing, God. Please help me. And will you pursue dry stubble? For you write bitter things against me and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. You put my feet in the stocks and watch closely all my paths. You set a limit for the soles of my feet. Man decays like a rotten thing, like a garment that is moth-eaten. What a very morbid picture of man. And yet when you go through trials, you do have a different perspective on life, don't you? Those of you who went through some heavy pain, life takes on a different meaning. You look at it quite differently. You realize it's frail. You realize how frail it is. When you get sick, you realize how frail health is. You take for granted health when you're healthy. You don't even think about it. It's when you're sick and you appreciate that health. You appreciate being able to just walk and run and breathe deep and just feel the air. You appreciate little things. Job is expressing in all his difficulties just how frail life is and how empty and how man decays like a rotten thing, how temporary it is. Man who is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. He comes forth like a flower, fades away, flees like a shadow and does not continue. How temporary, how vain life is. How empty this life is in this world. How temporary, because realize eternity is what counts. If you're not preparing for eternity, you're making the biggest mistake of your life. If you don't know where you're going to be when you die, you are very, very, very foolish. Because this life is so fleeting. It's all going to be past. And if you're making decisions that are compromising in this life because of temporary gain, tax time is coming up and you're finagling those little bit of this and that when you know it might not be a proper deduction for you because you might gain an extra $10 or $20 in taxes, what is that going to matter in light of eternity? What freedom it really is to be free from the worry about things, so much so that you can be absolutely honest with your taxes and pay that money, yes, to a government that you're not completely happy with, but you pay your tax money that is due because you know what? Those things don't matter. What matters is being right, being a person before God, knowing eternity is coming. But man who is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. What a good picture of life on this world. He says, who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? No one. Since his days are determined, the number of his months is with you. You have appointed his limit, so he cannot pass. Look away from him that he may rest, till like a hired man he finishes his day. The idea there is, you know, it's just the end of our life is just like coming to the end of a work day. For there is hope for a tree if it's cut down that it will sprout again and that its tender shoots will not cease. Though it may grow old in the earth, its stump may die in the ground, yet at the scent of water it will bud and bring forth branches like a plant. In the desert, that's very true. You know, trees that could be totally dried up and you think they're completely dead, when the water comes back, they revive. But a man dies and is laid away. Indeed, he breathes his last, and where is he? As water disappears from the sea and as a river becomes parched and dries up, so a man lies down and does not rise. Till the heavens are no more, they will not awake nor be roused from their sleep. So as long as this physical dimension is there, he's in the grave. Oh, that you'd hide me in the grave, that you'd conceal me until your wrath is past, then you would appoint me a set time and remember me. In other words, he's saying, hey, why don't you just put me away out of my misery for a while, and then when this is all past, then come back to me. If a man dies, shall he live again? Good question to ask. It's a question that many people don't ask these days. If you die, will you live again? The Bible declares emphatically, absolutely. You'll stand before God. It's appointed unto man once to die, and after that, the judgment. All the days of my hard service, I'll wait till my change comes. Notice the inclination of the hope there of the resurrection. You've seen him in his depression where he just thinks darkness, emptiness, vanity, it's all blackness. Now you see, he says, there's a little bit of hope there. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my heart's service, I'll wait till my change comes. You shall call and I'll answer you. You'll desire the work of your hands. For now you number my steps. You don't watch, but do not watch over my sin. My transgression is sealed up in a bag and you cover my iniquity. But as a mountain falls and crumbles away, and as a rock is moved from its place, as water wears away stones, as torrents wash away the soil of the earth, so you destroy the hope of man. So you see here from 18 on, he's returning to his complaint. And reverting to that hopeless mood and speaking about death is inevitable and just everything's going to go down. But you see inclinations, a little spark of hope there in verses like 14. You prevail forever against him and he passes on. You change his countenance and send him away. His sons come to honor and he does not know it. They're brought low and he does not perceive it. But his flesh will be in pain over it and his soul will mourn over it. So speaking here of himself here, that how empty it is, and his sons come to honor, he doesn't know what he's brought. Then they're brought low and he doesn't perceive it. In other words, the whole purpose of life seems to be so futile. Good things happen, bad things happen. He's in pain. He's going to mourn over it. It's kind of a doleful end here to Job's discourse, and Eliphaz picks up where we'll pick up next time when we get into this. I covered quite a bit tonight in regard to these things, but I want you to see the whole feel together of what Job is saying. Job is keep expressing just an emptiness here, and yet intermingled in everything he's saying, there's little glimpses of hope and realizations that he will be vindicated. You know, he can't wait till he gets out of this suffering. No, I mean, that would be true for any of us. If you were in that, you just... that's all you could think of. Imagine going through what he's going through before the ages of painkillers. And we naturally assume you go to the hospital and if you're in tremendous pain, they give you morphine or they give you something to put you out and make you not feel the pain or put you to sleep. But imagine having to go day by day by day through intense agony, the grief, and then have your so-called friends there nipping at your heels. You're a sinner, Job. You've done it. You've got to find it. Tell us what you've done. We'll help you out. And you know you've done everything you can. You've sought your heart out. Lord, is there sin? Please show me if there's anything. I'll start confessing sins I haven't committed if it will help, you know. Anything. You feel that in Job's expression as he goes through here. And you also see the emptiness there as we see with Bildad and Zophar. Just really nothing to add except for a simplified theology that says, if you're good, you should be prospering. If you're evil, you're suffering. So Job, you must be evil. You also see the emptiness there, as we see with Bildad and Zophar. Just really nothing to add except for a simplified theology that says, if you're good, you should be prospering. If you're evil, you're suffering. So Job, you must be evil. Let's pray. Father, we are just hit hard with what Job is going through here. Our hearts really just are inclined to maybe be a little bit afraid that such a thing would happen to us. That you and your sovereignty would determine that it would be needful in us, in our lives, for such suffering to occur. And Lord, we are afraid of that. We're honest with that. We know you're sovereign. We know you know what's best, and we would trust you through it. But we do pray that if it be possible, that we could grow with quite a lot less pain. But Lord, ultimately, if you know our hearts and you know we would stray away, we would not trust in you and lean upon things in this world that thinking they will give us pleasure, if there's anything that would cause us to idolatry. And Lord, we would pray that you would break us from that.